faces I recognize. I don't see some faces I remember from last week, but I'm glad to be here. My name is Brad Young. I am a deacon ordained in February here, and I serve here at the Christ the King and other places when I have the opportunity. We are going to continue our talk on moral relativism. We're kind of using the materials from the Augustine Institute that Dr. Edward Shree led. So maybe you guys saw that stuff, maybe you didn't. If you didn't, then you won't know that I might have wandered away from what he was saying. All right, so let's get going. So last week, we talked about what freedom really means, that the worldly view of freedom is freedom to do whatever we want, kind of running a moral worldview like that video we just saw, that everything is subjective, and so freedom is me being allowed to do whatever I want. And we chose the word, or I chose the word, license to describe that kind of freedom and that definition of freedom. The Christian understanding of freedom is the freedom to be who God intended us to be and to be free of the burden of sin. So that is the objective morality worldview that was described in that little video we just saw. And we chose the word integrity for this definition because we are free to be a whole and integrated person. We also asked the question of why there is a moral law. The very simple moral law that they mentioned in this video, to love God and to love our neighbor. The more complicated moral law of the 600 plus laws in the Mosaic Law. The church's moral teaching, including all of canon law and all of the Ten Commandments and all of the other teachings that you absorbed in your Catholic school or PSR or wherever you were from your parents. And we saw that the laws of God and the church are not there to constrain us, but to protect us, and to protect us from sin and ultimately death. And we decided, or I decided, they're not constraints, but guardrails. And I gave you this picture of a fence whose purpose is to protect you, the not paying attention driver, from driving over, not making the curb and ending up in the pond. So that is what we talked about last week in terms of what freedom means and why we have a moral law. Is that ring a bell for those of you who were with us last week? Okay. So today we want to talk a little bit about that we can choose to live well. We know that God made us for a reason. I showed you that nice little package answer to the question from the Baltimore Catechism. That God made us to know him, to love him, and to serve him in this world, in this life, so that we can be with him eternally in the life to come. So we have a purpose. That's what God made us for. And so we know that we can choose to live and to live well. But what does that mean? And I put up, you know, in the various vocations where we find ourselves, what does it mean to live well as my son to my father or daughter to my mother and father? What does it mean for me as a husband to live well, to be a good husband to my wife or to be a good wife to my husband? And how do I live well in my role as a follower, as a servant, or if I'm in a leadership position? What does it mean to live well according to God's plan for us? And if we think about other things that we want to do well, we are open to the fact that we have to learn a little bit about how to do that well. if we want to learn to play the guitar well, we have to learn about strumming, and we have to learn about picking. That's this hand, I hope. And then we have to learn how to use the frets on the neck of the guitar, because we want to make beautiful sounds. Anyone who's watched somebody who doesn't know the guitar, he can make sounds, but it's not music. And so it takes some learning and then some practice to be able to play the guitar well. And we find that that's true for our lives as well, our moral lives. So what we need to do in order to learn to live well is to understand that we make decisions. So it involves our minds as well as our hearts. So we need to understand the role of our intellect. That's the term that Edward Sree was using. It's one of the ancients' term for the knowing function. And we need to understand our will. That's the term that they use for the choosing function. Those of you who are married, went through preparation, one of the things that the way the church understands marriage is that the intellect informs the will and the will decides. So when there are questions about the validity of a marriage, they're looking at whether or not the intellect was defective or the will was defective. So they're looking at those two functions, the knowing function, the understanding function, and then the choosing function. Okay. In his letter to the Ephesians, chapter 4, St. Paul talks about to speak truth in love. And what we've talked about so far are the foundation for how to prepare ourselves for a conversation or dialogue with other people. Because the truth of the matter is, many times those other people are not going to be familiar with the tools that we just talked about. I bet that this is new to some of you. Okay? So you've been raised in the church, and this whole tool set is something that you're not familiar with, which is a shame, because this is a rich tool set for us. But we have to be able to speak the truth in a way that people who aren't familiar with this toolbox can hear. So we have to make sure that truth and love are kind of the same thing when we speak. I always think of the woman caught in adultery and the woman at the well that Jesus talks to, about how he's able to speak truth to her, and yet she doesn't get upset. She rejoices that she thinks she has met the Messiah and wants to go tell her friends, even though he told her the truth about her irregular living arrangements. The world, and sometimes we, trying to be good Christians but still sort of affected by the world, operates so much of the time from its emotions and its passions. The ego, the sense of I, the sense of self, is central to how our neighbors think. And we need, when we talk to them, to be aware that much of the time, they don't think they're wrong with this. A video we saw, the one person saying that he likes this, and the other two people saying they don't agree with his decision, that's three different people having their ego, their sense of self, drive their intellect and their will. So when we talk to people of the world about matters of morality, we need to remember where we're going to find most of them, which is rooted in ego and desire, self-desire. There was a famous singer. He's long dead, so if you don't never heard of Frank Sinatra, that's fine. But his big hit was I Did It My Way. And it's a song about self-reliance and kind of getting it done even though there were odds against you and people didn't support you. I did hear a homily in which the preacher suggested that there's a jukebox in hell, and the number one song in the jukebox is "I Did It My Way." That sense of self becomes so powerful that we can't even really respond to God. And so when we're out trying to preach the gospel in our own particular way to people, we need to recognize how many of them aren't really equipped to hear, and they're not even aware that they're not equipped, that they are really driven by that sense of self, that's ego. On the other hand, everyone has experienced shame. He showed the example of when somebody tries to steal a cell phone, we all react the same way, hey, that's not right. So there are emotions and a sense of right and wrong that is actually universally shared. We do have, and other people who won't claim themselves to be Christians will acknowledge, that they do have shame. We as Christians would describe it where our actions don't match our beliefs, or where our will did not follow our intellect. I knew it wasn't right to spend the night after the party at her house, so I do the walk of shame the next morning back to my apartment, right? I mean, that's, we know that sense of shame. That may not be your example, but you can think of things where you realize after it's done that you didn't really want to do that. The church, of course, gives us the sacrament of reconciliation in order to put ourselves right with God and with ourselves. But a lot of the people that we're going to talk to about matters of good and evil, right and wrong, aren't aware of the sacrament of reconciliation or don't have access to it because they're not Catholic. So what should be our kind of guiding mindset is compassion. Compassion is suffering with. That's what pathos is. It's that the feeling and emotion, and the prefix com is to be with. It is so perfectly shown to us in Mary at the foot of the cross, being with Jesus as he slowly dies through a terrible death of suffocation and exposure on the cross. And she doesn't rail against the Roman authorities. She doesn't scream and yell at the Jewish high priests, who were the agents that got him on the cross. She just remains with him. And that willingness to be in a communion of suffering and love and presence will be our best guide for how we can speak the truth in love. So when we're talking with someone and they're clearly wandering down the route of self-focus and self-affirmation, and that's how they're dealing with their pain, we know the truth might be to say, for example, Jesus said, "You are right. You don't have a husband. You've had 5 different men and none of them your husband." But only Jesus is able to say that in a way that the person hears that and then turns and says, "I think I've seen the Messiah." So our model should be more like Mary and just to be with the person, and maybe the Holy Spirit will help us begin to let them turn around. But if we lead with a lot of truth and it's not wrapped in love, it will frequently not work out very well. And we who call ourselves mature Christians really need to model that type of compassion when we're talking with somebody. So what I'd like you to do at your tables is to talk about how your emotions have communicated back to you when your intellect and your will, when they were working together. So what was the kind of emotional feedback you got that made you know, okay, I'm doing the right thing? And perhaps, what was the kind of emotional feedback that you got that let you know that was a bad choice you made? So why don't you take a few minutes and talk at your tables about how you know through your emotions that you feel that you are either living well or not living well.
The microphone at the table.
There you go. It was like, what?
So, yeah, I'm really fast around the, it's going to go to all the tables. So, what kind of emotions, and I heard a lot of good discussion, so what were you guys talking about? What are positive and negative indicators?
Yeah, so for when we are living well, I think our table really talked about joy and how joy is the fruit of the gospel. And if we are kind of in this moment where we're thinking that, like, yes, I am just, like, filled with, like, happiness that is not temporary because I'm watching Netflix today, but more because I'm just in right relationship with God, my joy is an indicator that I'm in right communion and right relationship with Him. And one of the things we also discussed at our table was anxiety when we're not living well, because I think shame was already covered, and I think all of us in the room could probably relate to that in one capacity or another, but just anxiety, like knowing that like something is unsettled, and that's probably because like God placed a God-sized toll in all of our hearts, and only He can fill it.
That's great. Karen, right?
Back to you.
Yeah. So anxiety and joy, great.
Okay, so maybe one thing we were talking about at our table was, definitely the feeling you get. So one of the examples came up of, you know, if you've eaten too much pizza, you know, you're like, okay, I felt I ate one. That was modest. That was what I needed. Versus I ate three, I'm starting to feel bad. I feel progressively worse with each piece that I eat. And then kind of another idea was the response you get from others. So if you do something and you don't think about it, maybe you're not judging yourself, but then kind of the way that others are reacting to you is like, wow, that was really mean. You pushed a kid down a flight of stairs, you know? It's like, oh, is that wrong? Yeah, okay. So maybe it can kind of be a little bit of a check and balance when you're not catching yourself maybe the way you should, which I think kind of education is kind of the key to if you're not having a Catholic upbringing or Christian or a moral upbringing. At some point, you do kind of need that, or else you're not really going to have a way to judge. So I think kind of relying on sometimes the training of others to kind of help keep you in check, depending. Hopefully, you're keeping good people around you as well.
Right. Yeah. Remember, that was Cain's question, right? Am I my brother's keeper? Yeah, we sort of are.
So at our table, one of the main themes we hit on when you're living well is you're relaxed, you're happy. But the biggest one for not living well, in addition to echoing the anxiety statement from earlier, is also you kind of have this whole nagging guilt at the back of your mind, telling you that you probably shouldn't have done what you did, you know, echoing that shame as well. So you know when you're not living well versus when you are living well and how you perceive yourself.
Guilt. Catholic guilt. There we go. All right, thank you.
One of the things I mentioned at our table is that as a servant leader, I volunteer at Sunday school and work with the youth. I know that I live well if what I taught them in catechist class, that they're able to take those and bring it to life and take actions accordingly. So since I see those, I know that I'm doing well.
Okay, great. Sort of fruits.
Yes.
Fruits, you will know them. Always the middle table that thinks you're going to get away with not having to talk to anybody. So I can talk
to them. So I feel like our table had like an overarching theme of we are dealing with people and kind of if we're letting our ego drive that situation, whether it's with gossip or dealing with things at work, and then having somebody find out secondhand from like your actions, just that, I don't know, if I guess it's shame and guilt also, but just that feeling of, oh man, I should have handled that directly. That's what we're talking about. So just going straight to the source, and even if it's a tough conversation, you're at least living well. That was our, anything else?
It's hurt sometimes.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So in our table, we talked a little bit about the things you kind of do that you don't want to do that drives you nuts, like not sleeping too early and getting your life basically outside of control because you're not obeying your regular routine. Sometimes it's things that forces you to do it, like travel, too much work. We talked a little bit about the state when you're doing the things that you want to do and you have control over your life, and somebody called it joy. So that was something also we talked a little bit about that. And then we also brought, it's maybe a secular idea, but some people describe it as a contract. I actually read a book that touched on it and said, everybody has a contract that we commit to things to do in our day, and when we do not do those, we break our contract. So that makes us feel bad about ourselves. So that's, you know, that state.
Yeah, your own table?
Yeah, I was at this table.
Yeah, more of a manic personality. So if I'm leaving a trail of debris behind me, for me that's an indicator that I've lost perspective. So John the Baptist told his followers, for Christ to increase, he must decrease. That's also the motto that Bishop Ned adopted. And that's one of my little prayer thing I use is to remember, I must decrease that he may increase. Those are all good thoughts about how we can help figure out. A lot of times it's looked in the rearview mirror, and that's okay. Those were good choices, and those were bad choices, and what was at the heart of making good choices that gave me peace and joy and serenity and just a good feeling, one piece of pizza. Or when I kind of got out of control and ended up creating pain, experiencing guilt and shame because I eat 3 is not enough, 6 pieces of pizza. Okay. All right, good. Good stuff. Now, let's move to the word argument. We used it last week, and the woman who was sitting up here wasn't super comfortable with it, so I wanted to make sure we know what we talk about when we're using the word argument. Because an argument, as understood by the ancients, by Dr. Sri, by people who read the catechism, it's not a fight. It's an orderly search for the truth. So here is a picture of Bill Buckley on his TV show that went in the 70s and 80s, sitting with Mother Teresa. And you can see by their body language that these are two people showing respect to each other as they have a discussion to try to understand something more deeply. So if we're going to have a proper argument, which is how we're going to be able to prove things to people that we're talking to, we need to remember that an argument depends on clear terms, and I'm kind of using a pro-life kind of argument here. We have to know what we mean by murder. Murder is the intentional killing of an innocent human person, which is why killing in self-defense isn't murder, because murder is the intentional killing of an innocent human life, which is why death in war between soldiers isn't murder, because murder is an intentional taking of an innocent human life. Okay, so we know what murder means. And I use those other examples of people dying where we can see that's not murder. So the terms are clear. We know what a baby is. A baby is a human person at the very earliest stages of life. And nobody would argue that that's what a baby is. Then the statements that we make in our argument have to be true. The premises have to be true. It is true that the fifth commandment prohibits the intentional taking of an innocent human life. Thou shalt not kill. It is also true that abortion is the intentional taking of the life of the unborn baby. Nobody would dispute with the truth of that statement. They may not like it, but they acknowledge that it is a true statement. And therefore, we can make the argument that abortion violates the fifth commandment, because the two premises are true, and therefore the conclusion can be counted on as being true. So that's an argument. That's staying in the objective realm of reality. We said some things that murder can be defined objectively. Baby can be defined objectively. We can make these two objective statements, and we can show how on the basis of these two objective statements, a third objective statement is true. Okay? So that's deductive logic. That is how St. Thomas Aquinas used the logical structure from the Greeks, Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, to examine systematically the teachings of the faith. This big book is called the Summa Theologica. And it is this kind of argument. It sets the subjective part, how I feel about it, aside, right? Because if we talk to somebody and use this argument, they may stop being able to hear us because they may know somebody who was party to an abortion. And they never really thought of it as a baby. And so only now, in using these objective terms, a whole bunch of their emotion can well up, and all of a sudden they can't really hear anymore. And that's where we go back to making sure that everything we do is rooted in and supported by compassion. And that's why I asked the question about those emotional responses. When you see that person you're talking to beginning to get a little squirrely, pressing forward with your objective argument may not be the right choice. Maybe it's time to go a little slower, change the subject to the Falcons or something, because that person is no longer in a place of love where they can hear truth. So, argument is not the same thing as disputation. And here I've got another picture from another TV talk show that I think no longer exists called Crossfire. And you can just see from the body language, I think that's Tucker Carlson and Paul Begala and the guy who's married to Mary Madeline.
The Raging Cajun.
Yes, that one. Can't think of his name.
James Carville.
James Carville. But none of the three people on that set are particularly interested in a reasoned discourse. You can see by the body language, they are interested in winning the point. Probably driving ratings too. But we don't want to get in our discussion to the point where it becomes disputation. So if we find in our discussion about some truth that we know is truth, the truth of the church, and we feel in ourselves that what's happening is I'm like a wrestler preparing for the pin. I have departed from something that's going to be effective in building up the kingdom of God and slipped over into, you know, antagonistic talk show type of place. And that's not going to help the person I'm talking to, assuming I'm pursuing truth wrapped in love. So we want argument. We want to take the time and mental rigor to make sure we define terms clearly and that we understand these true statements that are valid premises, and then we can deduce the conclusion from it. Many times we end up in disputation because we started with the conclusion and are backing into the proof. And that's not, it doesn't really work. Okay, so what I thought we might do is spend a few time with material fallacies. Okay, these are the non-arguments that people use. And I thought I would go through some examples with you so you got a feel for the ways that arguments break down. The first one is irrelevance. And you're either ignoring the issue, you put out a red herring, something to distract them, a diversion, you've got an irrelevant thesis, or you've got an irrelevant conclusion. And I give you a couple of examples. You know, we should let Sam into our medical school because we let his father in and he did really well and made the school good. So let's take Sam. Okay. Obviously, the father and the son, they're not like God the Father and Jesus the Son. They're not one, they're different. What if Sam is an idiot? This is, you've probably heard these types of things. What do you mean I don't love you? I've been supporting the kids for 20 years when marriages are under stress. Well, the fact that he's been supporting the kids for 20 years doesn't really speak to whether or not he loves her, right? And then the ever fun, oh look, a squirrel. So just distract him. And it's surprising how many times they'll take the bait, okay? So when you're in a dialogue with somebody, it's important that you recognize that was one of those fallacies where he has taken me away from the argument. Now I can decide, as a person in conversation, whether or not I want to point this out to him, agree to stop the conversation and talk about the Falcons, or whatever we want to do. But part of it, this is the intellect, to recognize what's happening. Okay? Another one is the appeal to ignorance. Asserting an argument is true because you can't refute it. Such as, if you can't find any errors in the proposal, it doesn't have any. Right? What my parents didn't see didn't happen. It did happen, whether or not they saw it, correct? Or trying to put the burden of proof on the person you're arguing against rather than being on the person who's making the argument, which is where the burden of proof should be. And I use the Shroud of Turin as an example. If you can't prove it's the burial cloth, then you have to conclude it isn't. Right? Well, none of us were there, you know, watching the chain of custody from CSI to know that's what it was. But that's not a valid argument. He's just kind of knocked me off my point by throwing this up. Next, tu quoque. Everybody uses this one. That's Latin for you too. That's what tu quoque means. You also. Okay? You do it too. Don't tell me to stop smoking. You chew tobacco in school. Not related, but very effective at stopping the conversation, right? We hear it today many times, the way we stop what might start as heartfelt, sincere talk about, for example, racial animosities is, you can't talk about that because you're a man or you're a white guy or whatever it is. You just sort of say, you can't talk about it. And then the other one is that other people do it. Okay, so that what I did is no different from what is happening all over America. That those are both forms of saying, don't argue my argument. Get distracted by the fact that people do something similar, or whether it's the arguer or a third party. You see this a lot when you're discussing things. When people are in stress, they just throw this out. And then that's a signal to me as an arguer, this may not be fruitful. Okay, analogies are great things. They help us understand stuff, right? The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. Obviously, we can't describe the kingdom of heaven accurately. Jesus could, but he chose to use analogies to help us get a sense of what it is, okay? and they can help you make a point. This is a quote from Samuel Johnson, who's refuting the fact that because you're not a poet, you can't review a poem. And he says, you can scold a carpenter who's made you a bad table, even though you yourself cannot make a table, because table making is what the carpenter does. But you can see a bad table, and you're allowed to say that's a bad table, even though you're not a carpenter. So when we're thinking about analogies that we hear or we want to make, we want to make sure that the similarities are significant. And the example given here is, I'm not going to use simplified materials for my students, because you wouldn't give your kid watered-down milk, now would you? Those aren't the same thing. Denying your child proper sustenance isn't the same thing as making the materials to teach them calculus a little bit easier to get their arms around. Here's a good example of gratifying your sexual desires is the same as gratifying your thirst. Honestly, a fair amount of the world operates under this, but it's not a true, it's not a good analogy. And then an unborn fetus is no more a person than a coconut is a palm tree. We already defined baby, so we know that's not true. But we'll hear arguments like that to deflect us from, we'll hear responses like that to deflect us from the truth. Okay, and then there's the appeal to pity or to prestige. Okay, it's some kind of appeal to emotion. You need to give me at least a B on my paper or I'll lose my scholarship. A fair number of us in this room have probably said something along those lines to a teacher at some point in our academic career. Okay, to put guilt in there, you have to support affirmative action quotas in our university because of the legacy of slavery and segregation. That is a big part of why some of our policies are what they are, is because we still carry and are respond to that that sense of guilt about decisions that none of us made. I was born in 1961, and I don't have any personal memories of institutionalized racism. I do remember the servant's bathroom in my grandmother's house, but I went to school with black kids and white kids on the same buses in the public schools in Franklin, Virginia. So I don't have that memory, but many appeals are made on the memories that I don't have along these lines. And you guys are younger than me, so you have no memory of those types of things. Or exploiting the audience's respect for authority. All the disciples of Nick Saban are, by definition, going to solve our SEC team's problems because they work for Nick Saban, right? Most of the SEC coaches that aren't Nick Saban, I think, work for Nick Saban at some point because of this appeal to prestige. Or the Pope said we should take shorter showers to protect the planet, and that's a reason why you ought to not have a long shower. It doesn't really speak to the details of taking a shower. It's just some appeal to authority. It kind of ends the argument, ends the discussion. All right, and then appeal to force and ad hominem. Okay, this is basically appealing to force is when you argue like a bully. We had a public case that's gone up through the courts that if you won't bake cake for my gay wedding, I will have you brought up on hate crime charges. That's essentially what was going on. I think that was in Colorado a few years ago, okay? Or perhaps closer to home in the workplace, what do you think of my idea? And remember who signs your paychecks, you know? How easy is it for your boss to stop arguments by reminding you of his power? I think we're seeing in some of this stuff that's coming from Hollywood that it's not just our bosses that abuse their position of power, but most people who have power are prone or tempted to abuse it. And that's always those of us who are in leadership positions, and all of you I hope will soon be in leadership positions if you're not already, remember how tempting the abuse of power is, regardless of your walk in life. And the other one is this appeal to personal ridicule, to use character assassination as a substitute for argumentation. I'm not surprised he's opposed to immigration reform. He's a coal miner from Butcher Hollow, Appalachia. And that is really just smearing the character of the person making the argument rather than engaging in an argument with them. Because the implication here is that coal miners are idiots and everybody who lives in Butcher Hollow, Appalachia is an idiot and therefore not entitled to make an argument, which is not true. But that's the kind of technique people use to dominate the discussion to their preferred end, to be more like Crossfire in that picture that we saw. And then mass appeal, and it works. The bandwagon, I think I used the same, I don't know if there is a GX920, but you need to buy one because everyone in Atlanta wants one, so you know they're quality cars. Or flip it and make it individual. Buy the GX920 and stand out from the crowd. And we see in like car ads and other advertising campaigns lots of these types of appeals that are not good arguments. It has nothing to do with whether or not the GX920 is a good car. It's just appealing to the sentiment of the crowd as an attraction, or the sentiment of the crowd as something you want to not be connected with. The other one I put in here for bandwagon appeal is, why don't you want to go to Passion? It's where all our friends go to church. Right? Let's go be with the in crowd and go to church at Passion. This is an ad campaign from some time ago. L'Oreal, I think, is a woman's hair color. It's expensive, but I'm worth it. There's an appeal to being individual and being cut above. And then I think this is from the movie the Kingsman movies, okay? A bespoke suit is the only suit for a gentleman. And you can properly say with a good English accent, you can hear the kind of snootiness in the statement itself. And that's kind of what they're appealing to, right? They're not actually making a case for that a custom-tailored suit actually will fit you better and is worth the money because it'll fit you better. They're making the appeal on class. It's what a gentleman would wear, which isn't really an argument. It's just an appeal to emotion. Okay, so that's kind of fallacies. You guys have experienced them yourselves, I expect. You've seen them in advertising campaigns for sure. A lot of political ads depend on that kind of stuff. And the advertisers use them because they're effective. So you can see the discipline required to maintain an argument when the person you're arguing with doesn't know how to argue and then uses these as his argument technique, or knows how to argue and doesn't want to argue with you, so he uses these as his argument technique. So again, you're back to, what do I do when the person I'm talking to seems to have little or no interest in a respectful, mutual search for what is true, which is what the picture of Mother Teresa is supposed to show us. Okay, so we quoted in St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians about speaking the truth in love. That was from chapter 4 of the letter. And we just went through these fallacies that reminds us that we need to know what is true or false, so that we can express it properly with love, and so that our expression of it properly reflects Christ. We don't have to go looking for a fight, but we need to know when the person we're talking to might be looking for one. And then we need to figure out how we're going to respond. Some people, like C.S. Lewis, reason to the truth, but most people don't. Most people see somebody living a way that they find attractive. And that's being a witness to Christ. That's what a disciple does. He models himself after the teacher, and he ends up being a witness. The word martyr that we use, the Greek word means witness. So the reason why they're martyrs is because they witnessed their faith in Christ to the point of death. We may not be called to make the ultimate witness, but all of us as Christians are supposed to witness to our faith in Christ. So it's important that we know our faith and that we live our faith. So we need to know the truth, and we need to always keep it grounded in love and compassion. We need to live our lives in the second great commandment, to love our neighbor as ourselves. And we need to respect him, even when he's not as far along the Christian walk as you are. Not everybody who's behind me is desperately waiting for me to turn and tell them, hey, come on up here, and they need to go at their own pace. And I, out of love, need to be willing to let them go at their own pace, just as the people that are further along than me, I need them to let me go at my pace, confident that God has us all in his hand and we'll all end up in heaven with him. But we don't all go at the same pace, and there's no mandate that we all cross the finish line at the same time. So as we grow in our faith, we need to make sure we stay full of love and full of compassion. This is a quote I picked up in a Protestant Bible study, and I love it. He said that you may be the only Bible somebody else reads. How we live our lives might be the only Bible somebody we know ever reads. So quoting Ephesians 4:15 is not going to convict him of the truth. Living Ephesians 4:15 will convict him of the truth. So when he looks at us, what will he think about God? So what I'd like you guys to talk about next is to think about in your own lives those books of the living Bible that convicted you or transformed you. I'm sure each of you can think of somebody you knew well, you didn't know all that well. The choices they made, the way they lived, spoke to your heart in a way that a textbook just couldn't do. Okay? We'll talk about that. Pretty gray, going white hair in this little bun. She's very involved in MUST, the shelter for homeless people, I think is what MUST is for. And her name is Carol, and I never remember her last name. But I have been watching her for 25 years as a Catholic. And she has this sort of Mother Mary type of peace about her that I don't have much of, and I really want it. And so, like, for me, that's one of the books that I read when I see her. You know, I don't even really know much about her, except I want what she has. And I think so these models that we have, that's a positive one. The idea that we might be a negative model, or we know negative models in our own lives, but not equally powerful. I think that why the Bible is so big, because we need lots and lots and lots and lots of lessons of this, and lots of different models. And some models that appeared negative turn out to be very positive. I'm always reminded of King David, who is a very negative model with what he does with Bathsheba and arranging the murder of her husband Uriah. But when he sees what he's done, he is a model of contrition, and he ends up being the model of the king that they're all waiting for when Jesus comes. So, you know, we got to read the whole book all the way through to get it. What I'd like us to do to close is pray together something called, here we go, the Litany of Humility. Father Dennis Dorner gave this to me as, is that something you're familiar with?
Yes.
Okay, great. Megan? This is...
Morning.
Okay. Yeah. So this is a something that Father Dennis Dorner gave me as a prayer tool in spiritual direction. And so you guys have done litanies before, so I'll say the non-bold and you'll say the bold part, okay? And we'll just go through this. So if you want to sit or stand, that doesn't really matter. Jesus can hear our prayers no matter how, what our posture is. Let's go ahead and pray this. O Jesus, meek and humble of heart,
hear me.
From the desire of being esteemed,
deliver me, Jesus.
From the desire of being loved,
deliver me, Jesus.
From the desire of being extolled,
deliver me, Jesus.
From the desire of being honored,
deliver me, Jesus.
From the desire of being praised,
deliver me, Jesus.
From the desire of being preferred to others,
deliver me, Jesus.
From the desire of being consulted,
deliver me, Jesus.
From the desire of being approved,
deliver me, Jesus.
From the fear of being humiliated,
deliver me, Jesus.
From the fear of being despised,
deliver me, Jesus.
From the fear of suffering rebukes,
deliver me, Jesus.
From the fear of being calumniated,
deliver me, Jesus.
From the fear of being forgotten,
deliver me, Jesus.
From the fear of being ridiculed,
deliver me, Jesus.
From the fear of being wronged,
deliver me, Jesus.
From the fear of being suspected,
deliver me, Jesus.
That others may be loved more than I, Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it. That others may be esteemed more than I,
Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it.
That in the opinion of the world others may increase and I may decrease,
Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it.
That others may be chosen and I set aside,
Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it.
That others may be praised and I unnoticed,
Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it.
That others may be preferred to me in everything,
Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it.
That others may become holier than I, provided I may be as holy as I should,
Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it.
In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Thank you very much.